The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. United States Senator Tom Cotton joins me. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
I'm good, Hugh. Good to be on with you.
Well, I heard you threw shade at me last week when I was missing in action, but I will forgive that because you're here this week to talk about the Blue Bank bailout. I think this stinks to high heaven, Senator Cotton. What do you make of this?
Yeah, it does stink, Hugh. It's pretty much Joe Biden and progressive failures all the way down. You know, let's step back 2 years and remember they created the environment that caused Silicon Valley Bank and potentially other banks to fail. It was their reckless spending that created runaway inflation, which led to higher interest rates, which squeezed banks in so many different ways. But even looking back 6 months ago, they should have seen at the supervisory level what was happening in Silicon Valley Bank. I mean, bank analysts on Wall Street saw this. You can't take in demand deposits at 3%, 4%, 5%. And invest them in treasuries that are at 1% or 2% for 5 or 10 years and not face that squeeze. And then 6 days ago, when it was clear that Silicon Valley Bank was on the verge of failing, they should have arranged some kind of shotgun wedding merger with a larger bank that had a stronger balance sheet. But I think the ideological opposition in the Democratic Party to any kind of merger, and frankly, just desiring state control of assets as opposed to private control, blocked that merger. And then even once Silicon Valley Bank went into receivership on Friday, they didn't have to bail out all the depositors. Now, the sympathetic parties here who are at no fault are the employees of the companies who had deposits at Silicon Valley Bank. But there were plenty of ways to protect those employees, ensure those companies could make payroll today and then again at the end of the month. The FDIC was talking about giving an advanced dividend of anywhere from 30 to 60%. Against the depositors' receivership certificates. Most of these companies are backed by big venture capital or private equity firms. Those firms could have fronted their payroll for 30, 60, 90 days if they were really such great companies. Or you had investors out there who are willing to buy receivership assets or receivership certificates for anywhere from 80 to 90% on the dollar, I've been told. Again, that would have made it easy for these companies to remain going concerns without the Biden bank bailout creating moral hazard now and in the future, and putting Arkansas banks and their customers on the hook to bail out these depositors at Silicon Valley Bank to include Chinese companies. As everyone knows, Silicon Valley Bank was an entrepot for American money in China. So it's been progressive failures all the way down, and we may not be done with it yet.
Oh, I don't think we are done with it. I had Senator Blackburn on earlier. I asked her the same question I ask you now. If a rural bank in your state was going under, do you think you'd get a blue state bank out bailout?
Well, Hugh, just to ask the question, I think answers itself. Of course, Joe Biden would not have bailed out some tiny bank that had facing failure in East Arkansas or South Arkansas. Or even more to the point, let's just make it an apples-to-apples comparison, Hugh. Let's say an equal-sized bank with equally reckless management in Midland, Texas, that almost exclusively banked the oil and gas industry, faced this failure. Oh. Do you think Joe Biden and his banking regulators would have manned the ramparts and done whatever it took to bail out all of those oil and gas company depositors?
That's a great example. You know, Senator Cotton, I've been asking people about Roku, and it's only because I know Roku and I use Roku and I like Roku. But Roku is run by allegedly smart people, and they had $600 million or thereabout in the Silicon Valley Bank, of which $250,000 is insured. So $599,750,000 of Roku money is not insured on Friday when Joe Biden announces no Blue Bank bailout. Sunday night, Blue Bank bailout. What happened in between? I want to know every call that went to everyone in the White House, the FDIC, Janet Yellen, by every lobbyist in Washington, D.C. This is a connected bank getting to their connections and working their lobbyists to get a 180 out of Joe Biden. And of course, he made it worse by denying that it's a bailout and thereby by increasing instability in red banks. I think that's what he's done. I think the market is going to crash today in banking again because they realize he's not going to do this for anybody who's not connected.
Yeah, well, Hugh, I can't speak about what any one depositor or company did or didn't do over the weekend, but I think there's no question that if you think about where this bank was located and the industry that it banked, as Mark Zuckerberg has said in testimony before the Congress, Silicon Valley is an extremely left-wing place, that you had a lot of Democratic donors and congressmen and local politicians like Gavin Newsom, who apparently had his own bank accounts at Silicon Valley Bank, burning up the phones over the weekend, insisting that they get a bailout. Again, all of these companies had different ways to access their funds or to get credit on those funds. You know, the FDIC had put out word on Friday and Saturday that they were prepared to do an advanced dividend of 30 to 60% of one's receivership certificate on against uninsured deposits. Those receivership certificates can be sold still today on the market if people want to get access to their cash quickly and reestablish a banking relationship with a going concern bank.
Senator, before
there's no question that lots of Democrats are burning up the phones to the Democrats and Joe Biden's administration.
That's what I just want to know who called the White House over the weekend. I will close with this on this before we move to Ukraine. The Intercept reported yesterday that Governor Newsom did not tell anybody while he lobbied for the bailout that he had three businesses, Cade, Odette, and Pump Check, three wineries owned by Newsom, clients of SVB. If that is in fact correct, should Gavin Newsom be testifying before the House Oversight Committee or the Banking Committee?
Well, he might end up testifying for a grand jury as well, if that's correct. I do think that there is probably a lot of feather bedding among people who were pumping the administration full of panic to get them to bail out Silicon Valley Bank, or around on Twitter all day long, all weekend long, talking about how the entire banking.
So now, Senator, I want to turn to Ukraine. Yesterday, Marco Rubio was on the show, and he made a lot of news because he suggested that Governor DeSantis' statement to Tucker Carlson about Ukraine was erroneous and perhaps not based in deep foreign policy experience. You know Ron DeSantis. He knows what he's doing when it comes to national security. And I think too much weight was put on that statement. But what does Tom Cotton think about the national security interests of the United States that are at play in Ukraine?
So, Hugh, as I've said before, I think we have vital national security interests in stopping Russia's unprovoked war of aggression in Ukraine. What we need in Europe is a stable, durable, lasting peace, so we're not always facing a potential two-front conflict when our biggest challenge is China in the Western Pacific. And anything short of that stable, durable peace is going to be a kind of festering wound that continues to take American attention, American forces away from China. The only way to get to that kind of stable solution is for Vladimir Putin to think he has more to lose on the battlefield than he does at the negotiating table. That's the only reason we'll have a negotiated settlement that's satisfactory to Ukrainians in this battle. For 22 years, Vladimir Putin has not sat down at the negotiating table when he starts this kind of conflict because he always thinks he can get more on the battlefield than he can at the negotiating table. That's why I've said from the beginning that the Biden administration has failed to provide Ukraine the weapons it needs in a timely fashion to defend its own territory. That's what needs to happen now.
Now, I am concerned that the axis of evil, the new one, Beijing as its capital, Putin and Khamenei as his vassal state operators, his authoritarians under their control, is becoming very much one block, and it's run by Beijing. So that what happens in Ukraine very much affects what is being thought in Beijing. What do you think Beijing thinks of Joe Biden's policy?
So I think Xi Jinping and Chinese communists are watching carefully what happens in Ukraine. They're probably surprised by the shortcomings of the Russian military, probably question whether their own military is misrepresenting their capabilities to them. That kind of uncertainty is a good thing. But they're also watching Western resolve as well. And if the West, especially President Biden, falters after a mere 13 months in their view, since they think in terms of decades, or generations or centuries, a mere 13 or 15 or 18 months, that there is no chance that Joe Biden and the West will stand united against the Chinese invasion of Taiwan in a year or two or 3 years, a small island on the other side of the world where Europe has no cultural or historic or linguistic or religious ties. So I think very much what happens in Ukraine could influence Xi Jinping's thinking on whether and when to go for the jugular in Taiwan.
Now, you're a member of the Intel Committee, Senator. Can you find out the Chinese Communist Party connected companies that banked at SBV through the Intel Committee?
I don't need the Intel Committee. You obviously, you have, it's widely known in Silicon Valley and Washington, that Silicon Valley Bank was an access point for Chinese companies to get American capital. And in almost all cases, those companies are linked, influenced, or associated with the Chinese Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army. And these are not just companies coming up with pleasurable apps for the Chinese people to pass their spare time. I mean, China wants access to foreign capital to continue to fuel its rise and inherent in its system of state-directed economics is the tie between those companies and the PLA and the CCP.
Let me put three dots on a map for you, Senator. Theranos, Sam Bankman-Fried, and now SBV. Is there a cultural problem in Silicon Valley? And that, and then let me add Stanford Law School, acting like children. So there are four dots. Can we diagnose something based upon four disconnected but geographically proximate scandals?
In a lot of those cases, too, you had people, business people who were celebrating left-wing causes and essentially buying themselves political risk insurance when they should have been buying themselves interest rate risk insurance, celebrating Democratic Party or progressive causes, basically putting down a future foot option that if they got in trouble, they could run off to their pals in Washington, D.C. and hope to be bailed out, as Silicon Valley Bank was.
Now, let's close there, Senator. If a bank crisis occurs today and the markets indicate one, Moody's downgraded the whole banking sector, I think the president has to come out and say, we're going to, everything that we did for SBV and Signature, we will do for every bank in America. It's a lot of money, but I think he has to say that for depositors. Otherwise, we could have a real crisis on our hands. What will be your reaction if he says that? We have a minute.
Well, I don't want to speculate about what might happen in the market today or what the Biden administration's response might be. But it's clearly been a failure of Silicon Valley Bank, and I'm afraid we'll find some other banks when it comes to just its own managers' risk management practices, but the Biden administration's supervision responsibilities. And I certainly hope that they are carefully examining all the banks that might face similar kinds of interest rate risk and urging them to take immediate steps to protect themselves and therefore their depositors against those risks.
Yeah, keep that Midland Bank, Texas hypothetical in mind. That is truly illustrative of the problem that we face with two legal systems and two political systems for banks. Senator Tom Cotton, always a pleasure. Thank you, Senator.
They couldn't stop Jack or the horses.
Welcome back, America. This is a rare triple play for the Hugh Hewitt Show. The Grand Old Pod will be devoted to this interview. The Highly Concentrated Hugh podcast will be devoted to this interview. And it's going to play on Thursday morning in the first hour because I want everyone who listens to this show to go out and get this book, Scalia, Rise to Greatness, 1936 to 1986, because it's a rollicking grand read. It's not because James Rosen is a friend of me and of the show, and he is. Not because I love the strong man, it's because I have long admired Justice Scalia, and I doubted that we would get a good book about him for a long time, but James Rosen has surprised me. Good morning, James. Welcome. Congratulations. This is a fabulous read.
Thank you, Hugh, for everything. That's so kind of you to say, and I'm grateful to be back with you.
Well, let's get right to my number one burning question. What happened to Justice Scalia's father's library? The volumes in the basement of the building that had like five different languages. And I think it was Eugene Scalia, maybe it was Father Paul, went in with him when his father died. What did they do with all those books?
That's a great question. I don't know the ultimate disposition of Salvatore Eugene Scalia's library. There is the scene in the book where Father Paul accompanies his father, Antonin Scalia, to the home of Antonin Scalia's father after his death to dispose of this extraordinary library that the old man had. And Father Paul Scalia, who was interviewed for this book, told me that what was most remarkable about all of those books arrayed before them was that they were divided not by subject matter or by author, but by language. That's how many languages Salvatore Eugene Scalia spoke. And it impressed upon the young Paul Scalia, later to become Father Paul Scalia, the importance of scholarship and work to this family.
You know, I've had three of the Scalias on the show, Father Paul, Chris, and Eugene. And so I don't know, Mrs. Scalia. I did do some work for Judge Scalia on the D.C. Circuit for about a month when my judge was sick. So I knew him a little bit, but not very well. I just got to tell you,
what term was that?
What's that?
What term? Yeah, what term was that?
83 to 84. And my judge, Roger Robb, who took senior status, had a stroke. And so Terry Ross and I were the co-clerks. And we got passed around from Scalia to Bork to Ginsburg to Skelly Wright to Spots Robinson. We all did like a week and a half or 2 weeks, and we got one case each from each of them. I loved them all. Scalia scared the hell out of me, though, because he's a big personality, as you know, better than most. We're not going to talk about your personal relationship with the justice, but you know he's a big personality. He scared the hell out of this 24-year-old guy who'd been working for Nixon. I got to tell you one thing in that regard.
I believe that it was Judge Robb's vacancy that Judge Scalia took when he was seated.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned earlier on the show, I might like Scalia a lot because it's the only book I've ever encountered where three of my first five bosses are mentioned within two pages, Roger Robb, Fred Fielding, and William French Smith. I work for him in order of Robb, Smith, Fielding. But I had dinner with Fred on Friday night, and I read your book on Sunday coming back from D.C., or I would have told Fred he had to go out and get this because it's really, you got the details on DOJ during the Smith and Meese years. You got the whole scoop.
Well, thank you, Hugh. First of all, I would suggest to you that given all the individuals you worked for and around at that time, that there's room in this world for a short memoir by you about your Justice Department experiences, I should think, and what relevance they may hold for today. That's just friend to friend and book lover to book lover. Yes, this book, Scalia Rise to Greatness, contains a vast wealth of new documents that have never appeared before. And I call it the first accurate biography of Antonin Scalia because it's the first admiring biography of Antonin Scalia. The two previous biographies turned out fairly hostile to Justice Scalia, to his legacy and his jurisprudence, his conduct, despite the fact that he cooperated extensively with one of those biographers. And so this is really the book that Scalia fans and all students of an accurate history of American law and society in the past 50 years have been waiting for. It ends with Antonin Scalia taking his seat on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think writing biographies of judges and justices is a very difficult business because they have very public lives, but very private dispositions. They cannot be out in public except in very extraordinary circumstances. You captured that visit to the Department of Justice before he was nominated and the speech that he gave. I didn't know any of that stuff. I mean, there's stuff in here that I should know that I do not know. Number one, I had no idea he was a Jones Day associate for 6 years. I went to Michigan Law School, which vetted all, as you point out, they vetted all the stuff that Scalia had done before he was nominated to the court. And it wasn't fair that Lee Lieberman wrote the OLC memo on him, but it was nevertheless fun to learn that from you. But I did not have a clue that he was a Jones Day lawyer. And the one thing that's not here, James, maybe it's not important to you, but I'm a law professor, so I want to know, how did he get from Jones Day to UVA? I mean, who opened that door for him?
That's interesting. You're the second person who's read the book to ask me that question recently. The question of how Antonin Scalia, having practiced law, private practice for Jones Day in Cleveland from 1962 to 66, 67, then transitions that year to go be a professor at the University of Virginia Law School. Young Antonin Scalia, when he was first hired out of Harvard Law School for Jones Day, told the folks there that he intended at some point to teach. But one of the, I would say, most striking revelations of this book, Scalia Rise to Greatness, is that we answer in it what had been one of the very few mysteries still enduring about Antonin Scalia's life. And that is when he first began to harbor within him the ambition to become a Supreme Court justice. The justice's most ardent defenders, his family, his clerks, others in academia, have always been leery of allowing this ambition to become a Supreme Court justice to be ascribed to Justice Scalia too early, lest it contribute to what they consider and what I consider the false narrative that was promulgated in the first two biographies, this sort of careerist narrative, which held that everything Scalia did, every opinion he wrote, was tailored to curry power and favor with more powerful people who could advance him to the Supreme Court. And of course, that's not true. I interviewed many people who worked with Scalia at all points in his career, and they all said that that's not true, that in fact, he was quite willing to issue controversial opinions, ones he knew would find disfavor even amongst his own colleagues and what have you. But in any case, this book makes use of so much wealth of new documents, Hugh, that I hope our readers will take, our listeners and our viewers will take the time to read it, because you have an oral history that Justice Scalia conducted in his own chambers in 1992 that had never been used by any biographer before. You have his FBI files, and you have his correspondence with Ruth Bader Ginsburg from the earliest days of their friendship. So there's really a lot here.
I'm going to come back to that. I'm going to come back to Furkey. By the way, on behalf of everyone who's ever worked on a Furk case, which includes me, it's very, very bad to say that Furk are the worst cases, even though they are the worst cases. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission cases, he left Ruth Bader Ginsburg and a Furk opinion to finish when he got elevated to the Supreme Court. I love that exchange. But mostly I love you down Opus Dei priest Father O'Connor in Rome at the age of 80. So is it O'Connor or Connor?
It's Connor.
Okay. Father Connor vanishes from medical school. Antonin Scalia goes to try and talk him out of dropping out. And you recount what Connor told you 2 years ago or 3 years ago. Tell the story, James, because that's a, this is an Opus Dei priest in Rome. He's not making stuff up.
He's now in New Jersey, but he studied Opus Dei in Rome. Yes. We're talking about, and this really gets to what we were just discussing about, one of the enduring mysteries of Antonin Scalia's life. If there are any, this was one of them, that we resolve in the pages of Scalia Rise to Greatness, I think decisively. This is based on my interview, as you say, with Father Robert Connor, still with us today, in his mid-80s, perhaps his late-80s at this point. He was one of only three people I could find who had been a surviving classmate of Antonin Scalia's from when he graduated from Xavier High School in 1953. Interestingly, Hugh, one of the other two besides Father Connor that I found was former Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, but who told me that he did not know Antonin Scalia at Xavier when they both graduated the same year. In any case, I asked Father Connor if he had ever been interviewed about his lengthy relationship with Antonin Scalia by anybody else, including the FBI. Because as I mentioned, we obtained the FBI files for Antonin Scalia. They were declassified after his death. He was vetted by the FBI four times within 14 years because of how quickly Scalia rose through the executive and judicial branches. Father Connor told me, no, he's never been interviewed by anyone about his relationship with Scalia, and certainly not the FBI, that he thought he would remember that. And so, in essence, what Father Connor told me has never been disclosed before. And what happened was that they were great friends at Xavier. They were on the marching band together. They played hoops together. Scalia set Bob Connor up with a date at one point. They were close, and they're pictured together in the photograph section of this book. By the time they got through college, they were still friends, but not seeing each other as often, but still had their folks living in Queens, you know. And at one point, Bob Connor decides he's going to drop out of med school and go study Opus Dei in Rome. And Mrs. Connor is distraught because she thinks her son is throwing his future away. So she summons to the house the two men that she thought might be able to talk sense into her son. One was a Jesuit priest, named Father Morrison, who did come to the Connor home on Downey Road in Queens, south side of the street. And there on that day, when Father Morrison came to visit him, Connor was sitting in his brother Jim's bedroom on the second story of that home. This is June or early July of 1959. Scalia was 22 at the time. And he was the second person that Mrs. Connor summoned to the family home on Downey Road in Queens that day to try and talk sense into her son. And Scalia was no stranger to this family. Bob Connor, Father Connor, told me that his own father used to see Scalia perform, which he did frequently, on television or on the radio, listen on the radio, when Scalia as a student appeared on like student quiz show programs of the 1950s. And his father would actually say to Bob Connor, "Oh, you should have heard it. Scalia really gave it to him this week." So Scalia had fans as a teenager. But in any case, he shows up at Bob Connor's house. It's the brother's room on the second story. They haven't seen each other in a while. And Connor is stunned to see Nino Scalia, his friend, and Scalia says to him, this is all according to the interview I did with Father Connor in 2020, as you mentioned. He said, Scalia walks in and says, what are you doing? And Connor says, I'm going to go study Opus Dei in Rome. I asked if Scalia, devout Catholic that he was, seemed to evince any particular understanding of what Opus Dei was. Connor told me, Father Connor told me that he had to explain it to Scalia, and he explained it that Opus Dei, they find the sanctity in everyday things, in everyday life. And Scalia nodded and said, sounds good to me. And then, according to Father Connor, he asked Scalia, what are you doing? And Scalia replied back to him, I'm going to the Supreme Court. And I asked Father Connor, was that fanciful?
And oh, we just lost you. We just lost James Rosen, so we've got to pick that up and edit that. Was that fanciful? It's an amazing story, and it, we'll get him back in just a second. It's an amazing story.
And
oh, you're back. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. I guess we lost me there.
Yeah.
And in essence, Father Connor says to Scalia, what are you doing? And he says, I'm going to the Supreme Court. And Father Connor said he had a job lined up in Ohio at a law firm. I said, yes, that was Jones Day in Cleveland. And he said, well, Scalia told me they have a Washington office, which then as now, Jones Day does. And he said, I will be sent to Washington and I will rise.
And you know, there's nothing wrong with ambition. What I love about this, James Rosen, is that Scalia's path was not uninterrupted by disappointment. In fact, it is marked by disappointment. He does not get into his first choice high school in New York, which I did not know. He does not get into Princeton. He does not get the Solicitor Generalship when he wants to be the Solicitor General of the United States. And what he does is work harder and work happier. There are two themes in this book, affability and hard work. Now, these happen to be James Rosen characteristics, and I would like to think I've got the same too, but they're kind of central to succeeding in Washington. You must be affable and you must work endlessly if you want to rise. And when he turns down the Seventh Circuit, to me, that is the greatest marker of the ambition of Justice Scalia, which, by the way, is a fine ambition. You can want to be at the top of your profession. That's a great thing to aspire to be. But when he turns down the Seventh Circuit, isn't that an underscore for you that he had his eye on the marble temple, as you call it?
Well, again, he announced to Bob Connor, later an Opus Dei priest, that he was going to rise to the Supreme Court. That was his ambition at 22. And as you say, there's nothing wrong with it. And those who are the most ardent defenders of Justice Scalia are all, like the rest of us, better off that he had that ambition so early and pursued it, obviously, within the bounds of propriety. Charles Schulz always said that he knew he wanted to be a cartoonist at the age of 5. And we're all better off that some people are blessed with that knowledge early on of where they belong and what they want to do. But in any case, I think that I'll let you take it from there, Hugh.
I want to talk a little bit about the extraordinary normalcy of Antonin Scalia. By that, I mean, I love the picture of him standing at the counter in the kitchen every night, having his whiskey sour, cheese and cracker, and reading the comics. And I guess Meg told you that. I don't know, Meg. That's a great picture of Justice Scalia, standing at the kitchen counter, having a whiskey sour, cheese and crackers, and reading the comic. Who reads the comics who's on the Supreme Court?
Well, I think that actual portrait is painted from his days on the circuit, Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. But it's also important to note that his father, who was a stern guy, a brilliant man and a professor of Romance languages, but a stern guy for whom an A- was never good enough, used to give Judge Scalia a hard time for reading the comics. The one point I wanted to add to earlier, which I'm grateful to have recalled, Hugh, is that you said, look, you got to be affable. And you got to work really hard to rise in Washington. And those are two essential elements in Scalia's particular alchemy, let's say. But really, the essential element is Catholic faith, too. And this book is the first, I think, biography of Antonin Scalia to really treat his Catholicism with the proper according of respect and place in his life.
Yeah, you know, James, that was very surprising. I'm a good Catholic, meaning I go to Mass every week, and I go to confession, and I am in communion with the church, and I take seriously the work of Vatican II, and I have never read anyone, you're not Catholic, and you understood that Vatican II's emphasis on documents and the emphasis on tradition and the emphasis on Latin and the emphasis on learning and on original meaning, right? That is Catholic doctrine that comes out. And you also explained, by the way, you're not a lawyer, but you explain the difference between original intent and original meaning better than most lawyers I know can do it. But you also fuse the Catholicism that Scalia lived with his approach to judicial matters, I think, very well. You want to explain it?
Thank you. Well, yes. And just to complete the trifecta, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a Catholic. I'm also not Italian. But we got to walk the mile in order to get to our biographical subjects. But when you talk about how Scalia's Catholicism informed his later work as a jurist, as a judge and a justice on the Supreme Court, he himself was very careful in how he described this. For one thing, in the oral history that he conducted in 1992 that had never been released until now, he discounted the idea that his Jesuitical training at Xavier and Georgetown directly informed his option for originalism and textualism. However, he also bristled when, in one case, a very good friend of his, this will be covered in volume two, dared to suggest publicly that Scalia's Catholicism was directly manifesting itself in his Supreme Court opinions. It caused a rift between Justice Scalia and this individual that went on for about 5 years before they reconciled. Justice Scalia never wanted anyone to imagine that he would allow his Catholicism to put its thumb on the scale, so to speak, of how he would interpret the Constitution or a lawfully enacted statute or agency rule. What he would say is, there's no such thing as a Catholic hamburger. But, he said, the closest we could come to a Catholic hamburger would be a hamburger that was made perfectly.
You know, when we come back for volume two, we're going to talk about Employment Division v. Smith. The only Scalia opinion I do not care for, and I believe it may have been influenced subconsciously by his faith that the Roman Catholic Church could endure anything. Other churches can't, but he wasn't. We'll talk about that down the road. I want to talk about rigorous Catholicism. I was reminded of A Bronx Tale as I read about his upbringing. Did you see that movie? Robert De Niro plays the bus driver with the son who's walking a path between bad guys and good guys. You remember that movie?
I saw the movie when it came out, Chaz Palminteri. I remember it.
Yeah. So it came to mind when you talked about his mother being deeply involved in Justice Scalia's life, making sure he hung out with the right people, which he did not realize until later. This is, by the way, the art of the biographer. Leon Edel called it the figure beneath the carpet. How do you find the figure beneath the carpet? And that always means the parents and the grandparents. And I so am impressed with your work into Sam and his mother. But explain how his mother was doing what Robert De Niro did in A Bronx Tale, trying to keep him away from the wrong people and in with the right people.
Justice Scalia discussed this in some of the interviews that he gave, one of them to his former colleague from their White House days, Brian Lamb, on C-SPAN. And when Brian Lamb just once asked Scalia, who was Catherine Panero Scalia? And he said, that was my mother. And he said that she made sure that I had the right associations. And when Brian Lamb pressed further as to what that meant, Justice Scalia said his mother made sure that he hung out with the right kids, had made sure that he joined the Cub Scouts, made sure that their meetings were held at her house, made sure she knew which subjects he was studying. Of course, Scalia's mother was an elementary school teacher, herself the daughter of Italian immigrants. You know, we're talking about family and its impact on Justice Scalia. But I have to say that I'm very pleased that in one of the reviews for Scalia Rise to Greatness that's been published so far, someone said that, in essence, that Justice Scalia is the protagonist of the book, but the hero is Maureen Scalia. And when we talk about the elements that fueled Scalia's rise, whether it was his Catholicism, his family influence, his affability, his capacity for hard work, let's just wrap that all under the word genius. There is also the hero, the dark side of the moon of the Antonin Scalia success story, and that is Maureen Scalia. Gene Scalia, the justice's oldest son, prominent attorney in his own right,
Secretary of Labor,
Trump cabinet official, yeah. told me that, you know, you're writing a book about my dad. I can name several very influential Supreme Court justices. I'm paraphrasing what Gene told me. But he said, I don't think I could name another person who pulled off what my mom managed, you know. And as the justice always said, he took care of the Constitution and Maureen took care of everything else. He said that she raised their 9 children with very little assistance from him. Now, I interviewed 4 of the 9 Scalia children, and they made clear their dad was by no means an absentee father. But when it came to their math homework, making sure they hung out with the right friends, had the right associations, getting them to their soccer games, this was all Maureen Scalia. And as he rose through the executive branch in the Ford era, in the mid-1970s, as now an assistant attorney general at the Department of Justice, Scalia traveled more and more. And I'm the first to really look at the calendar and also look at the sort of, if you will, the schedule of the 9 births. And there was a point where the Scalias had 8 children ranging in age from about a year old to 1960, 15 years old. And Antonin Scalia would be away at a conference in Germany for 6 days or in Italy for 2 days doing ABA work. And it's really extraordinary.
Let's pause on that, James. My daughter's a mill spouse with 4 kids under the age of 11, and her husband is deployed a lot, Navy guy. And I'm amazed that she can handle 4 on her own. I do not know how Maureen Scalia does 9 halftime. So you're right. You give her due. I do want to tell you my favorite Scalia's dad story, though. I can't remember which boy gets in trouble for bottle rockets in Chicago and picked up by the University of Chicago police. But tell that story because it's a very unexpected result.
So this was told to me again by Eugene Scalia, the former cabinet secretary, who attended University of Chicago in the late 70s when his father was a professor of law there. And Secretary Scalia related to me that on one occasion, he joined up with his friends, some of whom in the vanguard of this movement decided to start throwing rocks at windows at a nearby apartment building from a park. And as Secretary Scalia described it to me, he was not one of the rock throwers, but he was among them. And of course, he was the one who was picked up by the University of Chicago cops. And you know, they said, we're going to have to tell your father. And they dragged him down to wherever they dragged him down to. And, you know, they ratted him. And he went home and was confronted by his father, Professor Scalia. And the first thing Professor Scalia said was, you know how bad this is? And young Gene Scalia said, yes, I do. And there was a pause and maybe some preliminary discussion of the potential consequences. But finally, then Professor Scalia says, well, in my day in Queens, you should have seen the M80s we used to like. So stepping out of character.
That is a legendary explosive beloved by adolescent boys, the M80. And it shows up in Justice Scalia. We can't give everything away. People have to read it to enjoy it. I am reminded of Ulysses Grant being said, tell me about the boy and I'll know the man. And I think your retelling of Justice Scalia's years in Queens, his riding on the subway with a rifle back and forth to Manhattan every day, that's going to shock a few people, right? If you see anyone with a rifle on the Manhattan to Queens subway, you're going to run today. But evidently it was a daily occurrence for Xavier High School students, right?
Yeah, and as a justice on the Supreme Court, Scalia loved to tell that story.
I just think that I didn't know that. Let me go to the end of this first volume to, by the way, the White House Office of Technology Communications Policy, OTP. I did not know that Scalia was a Nixon appointee. I did not know that Brian Lamb was a Nixon appointee, and I did not know that they worked together. Now, Brian does me the great honor of listening to this show most days. Best interviewer in America, I think. And he should come out of retirement and go back to doing what he's doing. But he tells the justice, I'll do the PR, you do the law. I love that exchange. Did they stay friends throughout their entire D.C. careers?
Yes, I would call Brian Lamb one of Justice Scalia's closest friends for something like 45 years. And Brian Lamb's all over this book for you C-SPAN lovers out there. I did an interview with Brian at C-SPAN in 2017 for this book, and his insights are unlike anybody else's, except when they're corroborated by others. And he will feature prominently in Volume 2 as well.
You know, it's just amazing to me that I did not know that until I read this book, because Brian Lamb is the last guy to drop a name.
Hugh, may I offer one additional word about the OTP? So this was it was a new agency created by the Nixon administration called the White House Office of Telecommunications Policy. There was a recognition on the part of a particular young aide to Nixon named Clay Tom Whitehead. Tom Whitehead was an absolute genius with multiple degrees from places like MIT. He worked for RAND. And he saw that telecom was the future, and he saw that the federal government's approach to it was a mess of policies across many different agencies and should be consolidated under the administrative control of the White House. And when they set up the new agency and said, go do it, Tom Whitehead's first choice was to hire as his general counsel Antonin Scalia, who's about 35, a little older than Tom Whitehead. The two of them revolutionized the world together. And I'm the first researcher. This book, Scalia Rise to Greatness, is the first book to publish Antonin Scalia's correspondence and handwritten notes and letters and draft opinions when he was the general counsel to this new telecom agency. And they crackle with the usual Scalia wit. But what the chief thing that Whitehead and Scalia, they were sort of like a Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid for the telecom revolution in the early 70s. What they managed to accomplish was what they called the open skies policy.
Yes.
Which was that not just one place, ComSat, could launch domestic space satellites, any qualified corporation with the requisite technical prowess and capital reserves could launch domestic space satellites. This is what turbocharged the telecom revolution. And in those papers of his, Scalia actually predicted the internet. In 1971, he wrote a paper called The Computer Society, in which he predicted that remote users at different terminals would not only have access to hundreds of channels of TV, but would do their banking from there and could retrieve information from any library in the world. And he also predicted the attendant privacy concerns. So again, to learn, as I did in researching this book, that Antonin Scalia and his legal genius were present at the creation of the telecom revolution in this country. Again, it's one more way in which he touched just about every American.
I'm curious, were you not intimidated? Look, Lee Lieberman Otis is one of the smartest people I've ever met. She was a clerk for Scalia when I was a clerk for Rob. And she is one of your sources, and she talked to you, and she wrote. When you talk to Lee Lieberman Otis, or when you're reviewing OTC general counsel opinions, you're deep into the weeds of legal arcana. Were you at all put off by that challenge? I know you did the John Mitchell book, but that was more politics than law, because he's the AG and he's making decisions. This is pure law, but yet you just dove in.
So I am the son of an attorney. My dad, now only retired for about 3 years, is 88. So I came to, my professional life, I suppose, with a certain lawyerly cast of mind. At least I'm willing to play one on TV. But yes, you're quite right that it is daunting for a non-lawyer to wade into opinions and draft opinions and to have to learn some of the terminology like per curiam and what have you. At the outset of the project, two individuals who were interviewed for it, Ed Whalen and Leonard Leo, were talking about it. And Ed, I guess, said to Leonard, or expressed to Leonard some concern that James is not a lawyer for this project. And Leonard Leo replied to Ed Whalen, yes, that's why James is perfect for it.
That may, by the way, I agree. That may be why it's the only readable biography. Now, I love Clarence Thomas's book, his memoir, My Grandfather's Son. And I loved Evan Thomas's first about Sandra Day O'Connor. But they were both, one is personal and the other is postmortem. This one comes out afterwards, but it's two volumes. It's riveting. I mean, every page, people learn something. I want to go to the end, though. Before we run out of time, I want to put the cherry on top. Scalia gets confirmed 98-0. I love the conversation with a fellow by the name of John Bolton, who calls him at the Willard Hotel to tell him he's been confirmed 98-0. And Scalia wants to know, who didn't vote for me? And it's Goldwater and it's Garn. Am I right about that? Goldwater and Garn?
You are correct.
And, yes. And he will not let it go. And it's sort of a little perfect piece of cherry on the top. He just wants to know who the two people are, because you recount in great detail the requisition, which I lived through. I was over at OPM. I had nothing to do with it, but I watched it as a member of the administration. The requisition was hard. And then Scalia skates through with everyone trying to kill him, but no one can touch him. You devote a lot of time and to President Biden's participation in it. Was that strategic on your part to sort of draw attention to the confirmation process then and what it has metamorphized into now, which is a horrible, terrible meltdown.
I don't know, as I describe it, as strategic on my part, but it was certainly deliberate on my part that I wanted to place the Scalia nomination in the context, the proper context, which is not just that he won 98-0 confirmation, but also that his confirmation took place at close to the dawn of what was becoming an uglier era. The original Rehnquist Supreme Court hearings in 1971 were pretty ugly. When he was elevated to Chief Justice in 1986, it guaranteed it was going to be uglier still with the media landscape so changed. Honestly, if you and I have talked about this previously, I think, Hugh, that this really dates back to the Fortas episode and the knocking of Fortas off the Supreme Court by Nixon and Mitchell and the payback that was then executed against a perfectly qualified nominee in Clement Haynsworth. And then you get Carswell and off to the
not races. Qualified. But this, Carswell but this is not qualified.
This did not originate. This did not originate with Judge Bork in 1987, is what I was trying to show. But yes, and to the question of whether I was being strategic, again, I don't know that I'd use that word, but it was deliberate on my part to draw attention to the role of then-Senator Joe Biden in the Scalia process, because it's never been examined at length or critically previously. And so this is the first critical examination of Mr. Biden's participation in the Scalia process. And honestly, he didn't distinguish himself.
No, he did not. And despite a bit of a compliment, I can't put my finger on it. His discursive approach somehow opened up some opportunities for Scalia to talk. And so you pay the president a backhanded compliment, but mostly he's dense. He's mostly missing the whole deal and trying repeatedly to get him to say things he doesn't want to. Let me close by talking.
At one point, Senator Biden says to the nominee, Judge Scalia, forget the Constitution. Let's talk politics.
Yeah.
Any Supreme Court nominee would be well advised to follow that counsel.
I always thought that Ruth Bader Ginsburg invented the Ginsburg rule. Scalia actually invented the Ginsburg rule, as you recount on Marbury v. Madison. What an elegant answer. People have to read it to get the elegant answer, because he was going to be asked, they were going to pin him down, isn't Marbury v. Madison as good? And the rule was, if you talk about one case, you got to talk about every case. So how do you answer the Marbury question? James Rosen tells you. Democrats on the D.C. Circuit, including Harry Edwards, great liberal lion of the court, Abner Mikva, great liberal lion out of Chicago and Appal, Pat Ward, a superb judge. David Bazelon may have been in his early stages of dementia when the endorsement came down, but Skelly Wright, Spots Robinson, they all endorse Scalia. I mean, that's unheard of now, isn't it?
Very much so. That was a different day and age, but it was a different kind of court. One of the themes we'll be exploring in the early chapters of the second volume, which I haven't discussed anywhere else because I haven't written it, but it will be the sort of sense of disappointment that Scalia found once he finally started serving on the Supreme Court, that it wasn't the same kind of court he had really enjoyed from 82 to 86 when he was on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, a real murderer's row of judicial talent at that time that included Bob Bork, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Antonin Scalia, and
Ken
then
Starr.
Are then joined by Ken Starr and
George
Silberman.
Lawrence Silberman.
So, but the two courts functioned very differently, and one was more collegial and given to debate, which Scalia loved, and the other, he found a very different experience, and I'll be exploring those themes in the second book.
You know, I did not know that the Ruth Bader Ginsburg-Scalia correspondence had been open, because I read Nina Totenberg's book this summer, Dinners with Ruth, and she discusses the great relationship between them. But the esteem that they held for each other at the circuit was widely known by the clerks on the court. I didn't see it firsthand, but I knew about it. And you got the correspondence. How did you even find out that it was there?
So there's about 220 boxes of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's papers stored at the Library of Congress. Her papers from her Supreme Court tenure remain closed. Just about all of Justice Scalia's papers at the Harvard Law School Library remain closed. In fact, when I asked my colleagues and friends who are the custodians of the Scalia collection at Harvard Law School Library if they could help me nail down the date of my second lunch with Justice Scalia, that I knew it took place in the fall term of 2001, they replied politely that they wouldn't be able to help me because that segment of Justice Scalia's papers will remain closed until 2032. But Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg's papers from her tenure on the D.C. Circuit are open, as are Robert Bork's, as are Skelly Wright's, and others. And the way these courts function, all of these judges and then later justices, they circulate memoranda back and forth and draft opinions back and forth, and they comment and they scribble on these things and they make jokes. And it's and so it's almost as if every judge has the other judge's files. And so a lot of, even though Scalia's papers remain closed for the D.C. Circuit period, I now have access to a lot of his papers because they show up in the folders and the files of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and
I am astonished by that. I really am. I'm thinking back to one case in particular where Judge Bork was very unhappy with Judge Robb and let him know it. And I didn't know that those papers even existed. And I didn't know. You've done an amazing bit of research here. Let me conclude by talking about your book tour. Every Legatus chapter in the country is going to want you to come and talk about Justice Scalia, the Catholic. Legatus being the organization of Catholic businessmen and women who are CEOs, CFOs, et cetera. And every Federalist Society is going to want you to come and talk, James Rosen. You've written the book for both of those audiences. How is demand? I see it selling very well at Amazon, but sometimes, you know, you do a two-volume work, you always have to worry about whether the first volume will take off. But this is about a kid from Queens, so I think it will. How's it doing?
Seems to be doing great, thanks to a lot of friends like yourself who have given us the space and the time to promote it. Again, this book, Scalia, Rise to Greatness, this is the first admiring biography of Antonin Scalia, so it's the first accurate one. It makes use of so many different files and personal interviews and sources that were either overlooked by or unavailable to his previous biographers, who were in any case hostile to him and to what he stood for. And it's the first book to really explore the dimensions of his Catholic faith in a proper way, I think. So it's the book Scalia fans have been waiting for, and it's the book that you want to read and perhaps give as a gift if you want to know an accurate history of the last 50 years of American law and society.
I wholly second that. James Rosen, thanks for so much time this morning. Congratulations on Rise to Greatness. Scalia, Rise to Greatness. I look forward already to Volume 2.
Hugh, thank you for so much time.
My pleasure. Joined now by United States Senator Marsha Blackburn. Good morning, Senator. Welcome. Always a pleasure to have you.
It is always so good to join you. Thank you for having me.
And today, not only are we talking to most of Tennessee that we always talk to, we have added the mighty 990 AM in Memphis, also on 107.9. So we're now covering the heart of your population center in Memphis. So, Senator Blackburn, keep coming back. I want to talk to you about SVB Bank. And I know you're not on the banking committee, but you're on the finance committee. This stinks to me.
Right.
It just stinks to me because Biden and Yellen said on Friday, no bailout. On Sunday, we get a bailout after Gavin Newsom and everyone from Silicon Valley works them over. If this was a bank in rural Tennessee, do you think they would have walked in and helped it?
They would never even have spoken about a bank in rural Tennessee. But this is more of Joe Biden's blue state bailouts. He continues to do this. Look at the student loan forgiveness program. Who is the main beneficiary of that? It is high income earners. You have over 40% of the loans that are held in student loan forgiveness held by high-income earners, doctors, lawyers, PhDs, researchers. And so that was a gift to the rich. And then you look at SVB, and you find out their board is Democrats. They give to Democrat causes. They are more concerned with managing risk when it comes to diversity, equity, inclusion, and environment and social, but they don't get around to the G in that, which is governance. And that's where their emphasis was. That was their priority. Their priority was not on protecting those deposits and having deposits available for their depositors. And of course, they were primarily there for a lot of the tech and the green energy industry. It wasn't like a retail deposit bank that you would find with customers that are coming in, small businesses. That's not what you had in SVB.
The other bank that got bailed out over the weekend was Signature Bank in New York City. I was just reading about it. It caters to New York City real estate developers. So we have a blue bank in Silicon Valley and a blue bank in Manhattan getting blue money from blue Democrats. And I just think it stinks. And I think every minute of the day from Friday to Sunday, because of the huge evolution, has to be tracked down. Now, that's not going to happen in the Senate, because neither the Finance Committee nor the Banking Committee is going to look hard at this, but I hope it happens in the House.
Well, there are members of us on those committees that will be looking hard at this. And you cannot continue to have two tiers of justice, two systems of government, two different types of responses. It is to be equal treatment for all, equal application of the law. And what you did, or what you saw with this SVB situation, with the Biden administration, with Yellen, was an immediate jump to, oh, we're going to cover all deposits. Now, think about that, changing this premise and putting the federal government, the U.S. taxpayer, as number one in line to guarantee these deposits. And you, I want to know where these deposits are from. How many Chinese Communist Party banks are there? Are we protecting foreign investors?
Well, we are protecting Roku, which is, in my view, the dumbest company in America, because they had $600 million in deposits in a bank with a $250,000. It's just astonishingly stupid.
Well, it all is. But see, when the left screws up, they depend on us to come bail us out and say, oh, don't believe what you're seeing. Don't believe what you're seeing. We didn't really mess up. Oh, that's not us. It's not our fault. Nothing is ever their fault because of them.
I hope you have hearings on it. I want to ask you about the second thing that James Comer came up with, a $3 million transfer to Hunter Biden, a business associate that got divvied up among the Biden family. And there's an unnamed Biden member, could be the president, might be a brother or sister, might be James Biden, got part of it. Are you following this story? I mean, it's in the New York Post. It's nowhere else. Sean Hannity covered it. I'm just curious, are you aware of the Hunter Biden investigation?
Yes, we are aware of that. And we're so proud of our colleagues in the House who are stepping up and moving forward with this, even though you've got the mainstream media beating up on them left and right, six ways from Sunday. I mean, they are all over them, trying to blame them for divisiveness and mean politics. But what we have to realize is there is this paper trail, there is this money trail that goes from the Biden family it traces back to some of these Chinese Communist Party officials. And when Joe Biden, as a candidate, stood there and said he had nothing to do with Hunter, he had nothing to do with Hunter's business dealings. He was very proud of his son for his recovery, things of that nature. And then to get this information and to see that this is all a fabrication on Joe Biden's part, and that there was a trail and there was a participation of the family in the receipt of these funds.
Now,
and
Senator, you're on Judiciary. You had Merrick Garland in front of you. Did anyone ask him why there hasn't been a special counsel appointed for Hunter Biden yet? It's like straight out of Central Casting special counsel application. The regs apply to this. Why isn't there a special counsel for Hunter Biden?
And I don't recall if any of my colleagues asked if there was a special counsel for Hunter or not. I went after Garland on the two tiers of justice and how we seem to have one participation in one regard and not in another. And
does he seem infirm to you?
Pardon me?
Does the Attorney General seem flustered and infirm to you? I just was startled by how
very frustrated. And he even, when I was asking him about why he wasn't going after some of these people that are firebombing pregnancy centers, he went on to say, well, it was easier to find people who protested in the day than people that did crimes at night. Oof. You don't need the attorney general under oath saying it's hard to find people that do crimes at night.
Yeah, but so were you shaken by his? I mean, I really, it was like when Mueller showed up to testify on the investigation into Donald Trump, and everyone said, wow, that guy, it doesn't look good. Merrick Garland did not look good to me, Senator Blackburn. No, did he look good to you?
No, he did not look good to me. And I left that hearing saying, thank goodness he's not on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, that's well put. So, Senator, I want to close by Ukraine. I had Marco Rubio on yesterday, Tom Cotton coming up, both are Ukraine hawks. Where are you on aid to Ukraine?
I think that what we have to do is be sure that Vladimir Putin does not win this thing. We need to have our friends in the EU and NATO step up and be more proactive on their participation there. I do think that it is noteworthy that the first three contributions to the NATO Common Fund this year came from Japan, Australia, and New Zealand, because they know that the CCP is watching very closely what happens in Ukraine, and they're wanting to see if the U.S. is going to stay with this.
So is it in our strategic national interest to defeat Putin in Ukraine, not to carry the war into Russia, but to defeat Putin in Ukraine? Is that in our strategic national interest?
It is important that we have transparency and accountability around what is happening in Ukraine. And it is important that we do not give Vladimir Putin a win.
Marsha Blackburn, Senator Extraordinaire, thank you. The Mighty 990 in Memphis thanks you, as does Nashville and everybody else, Sparta, everywhere I am in Tennessee. They love hearing from Marsha Blackburn. Thank you, Senator. Let me close today by saying, if you are one of the people who did not have their $600 million taken away from them, maybe you want to be generous. Maybe you're feeling better. Maybe your bank did not collapse because you got a bailout. Good. Maybe you should be generous to Food for the Poor. I've got a little clip of someone describing hunger in Central America and Venezuela and the Caribbean. Can we play that, Adam?
Around 3 out of every 4 Venezuelans now live in extreme poverty. But this isn't just happening here. Hunger is spreading like a virus across Latin America and the Caribbean. More than 59 million people in the region are going hungry. The hardest hit countries being Haiti, Honduras, and Guatemala.
All right, so Food for the Poor goes to where the need is the greatest, and they get rice, beans, and clean water to the people who are starving. That's what they do. That's their core mission. They deliver. When you give them $100, I think like 92 of them get done. I mean, they turn into rice, beans, and water, and it might be higher. They've been doing it for 40 years. They are trustworthy. The Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I contribute to them because they are trustworthy, and it's Lent. And if you can give up anything, give up a Starbucks today and give it to Food for the Poor. The banner is over at the top of HughHewitt.com. The phone number, which I can't find because Dwayne didn't give it to me. Don't go to the phone number. Just go to HughHewitt.com. Find the Help Stop Hunger banner at the top. Takes a second to load. Count 1, 2, 3, you Steelers fans. That's not too hard, right? 1, 2, 3. And then you go and contribute and say, that's my Lenten sacrifice. And good for you. It's well and truly done. Thank you all for listening. Senator Cotton's interview will be posted. The transcript will be posted. And I'll be back tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.